Welcome to Whistleblowers, episode 9. 45 years since the disappearance of Juanita. The drug cops' home raids of this week. The price of drugs. And the Spider-Man coming to you today on Whistleblowers.
She believed in her principles. She believed in the right of ordinary Australians to have their say and be respected and not have to suffer for it.
Victoria Street, King's Cross. Worth saving, you'd think, from developers and their high-rise apartment blocks. Juanita Nielsen fought to protect it, and for that, she lost her life.
She certainly was aware of danger around her. She was aware of the history of what was happening.
Editor of a local newspaper, heiress to a family fortune. She was not your average radical. And David Farrell, business partner and boyfriend, knew her better than most.
This was the street where I lived for 7 years. This was Juanita Street. She was part of this community and she died for this community. But here we are. This was
still standing, number 202 Victoria Street, the tiny terrace they shared.
It's 20 years ago. What do you think about when you see this house again?
I think of a lot of good times. I think of the worthwhile things that happened in this street, and that I still believe that Sydney and King's Cross does have a heart. That heart's still there, and that heart remembers.
That story is actually 20 years old itself now. That story was made 20 years ago, and today's date, the 4th of July 2020, is 45 years since Juanita went missing. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
I'm joined by Jennifer Stone, Australia's Murder She Wrote. Crime author, investigative journalist, has been looking at the Juanita story all of her adult life. So before we listen to more of that broadcast from Channel 7, which is 20 years old, and Juanita went missing 45 years ago, why have they got it wrong, do you think?
Well, they gave you a clue in that story. It was the heart of King's Cross. You know, I believe she's at the heart, the centre of the underworld today. Back in 2011, I sent an email in November 2011 to the police. I got a letter back, which I was shocked about. That was correspondence from the New South Wales Commissioner of Police, dated 3rd of December 2011, was when they received my research. It was regarding the unsolved murder of Juanita Nielsen. It gave me a reference number, D/2011 for the year it was opened, and then 208952. That is a new case number for Juanita Nielsen. I actually did get information that was new to the case to reopen it, and that was where my compelling writing of the story regarding Juanita is to bring exposure to the position of the heart of King's Cross to raise her skull.
What happened to the cross is what has happened to all of Sydney, what has happened to the key, the centre of the city. There's just too much money around.
Only a few recordings of her survive.
A developer simply wants empty houses. They're more valuable. So, gradually, the people started leaving. There's very little of the old cross now.
You're going to endanger your own life, you're going to endanger the life of policemen.
By the early 70s, Victoria Street was changing fast, and the fight against high-rise development had turned violent.
Okay, so Juanita was certainly a very good investigator like yourself, and she started uncovering information probably a little bit wider than property development. What unfolded in these days and weeks and months before her disappearance?
Well, she said it herself in that tape. It was too much money. Where was all this money coming from? Remember when Frank Thiemann's development was getting built, the estimate was $60 million back in 1975. That's a lot of money back in 1975 when a point of heroin was $20 in America and some say $50 on the strip in Darlinghurst Road back then. So that's a lot. If all this development was through the alleged drug dealing, was feeding it, well, that's what Juanita, I believe, died for, because that's what she was exposing. What was feeding this development? The money.
With Juanita Nielsen's disappearance, he still lives in Sydney. David Farrell thinks he knows why Arthur King survived the abduction and Juanita Nielsen did not.
She would not, from my knowledge, have given in easily. It would have been like bagging a fox. It would be very difficult to take Juanita easily. She would have fought.
What do you think is her legacy?
Old Victoria Street really still has some things that are worth going there for. It still has beautiful plane trees. It still has a mix of people from all over with different thoughts. It's not quite as diverse as it once was, but it still hums along.
So there we go. We've heard from a report of 20 years ago, and today there is a small group of people meeting in the middle of King's Cross to commemorate Juanita and the Juanita Nielsen story. We've just heard from her ex-boyfriend there who lived with her in that unit, and people can go online and find out more about the Juanita Nielsen story. But you've been contacted by Channel 7 and somebody's organising something today. What do you think will ever happen with this story? I mean, so many cold cases have been solved over the years. You mentioned Juanita's skull and remains have never been found. So can you throw a little bit of light on, you know, in your mind, what might lie ahead with, you know, forensic science continuing to develop the way it is, even if we do uncover old DNA, et cetera, there still may be an end to this story in our lifetime.
Yes, there was. How I reopened the case was when I started to put the pieces together, the age of the guys were old, you know, about 20 years older than me, and they were threatening my life. And even this week I've had threats on Facebook to me, which I thought was interesting that as the, you know, the memorial time of Juanita, it's a very somber time, but, you know, the people will be gathering in Victoria Street with a red rose for some. A single red rose was what she loved. That was one of her favourite flowers. So it's interesting that some call it the Rose Cross that this gang had done to her, you know, that satanic rituals that I link into.
And police over the years, not just in this case but other cases as well, have gone beyond the realms of science when they cannot solve a case. And those detectives, we've heard many podcasts, you know, including Gary Jubelin recently, that have been saying they go outside, they're prepared to go outside the realms of what they've been taught at the police academies and, you know, what science tells them. And, you know, some of these leads go somewhere, but very often they don't. In this case, you believe there could be something, a wider net with the, maybe, you know, spirit world or underworld of that sort of dark nature?
Yes, well, the black magic was happening in King's Cross, 1975. There were meetings down Roslyn Street for that. It was Rosaline Norton would hold the meetings. The chemist shop would have a sign on Friday nights to not be open. You know, we had Juanita Nelson just a couple of days before she went missing was door knocked at home, and it was to do with a meeting at the Carousel Club. They needed her somewhere where they could get to her. But Juanita was gathering information on, I believe, 16 people, and there's a lot of research out there saying it, 16 dossiers she was collecting. One of them was allegedly a police commissioner at the time. Many of the high-profile people she was collecting information on would be dead now, just like Abe Saffron. We know Victoria Street, some of that development was curtailed through her actions. But remember, she was looking for the money. And that part of the story has never been the focus of any of the newspaper reports or the television. They focus about Victoria Street development. They don't focus about the money and where the money came for these developments.
And as we heard in that interview from 20 years ago, there isn't actually much audio of Juanita being interviewed, so much of her information has probably gone, been disposed of by now, that she might have been studying or keeping online. 11 months ago, the diary came forward, and so never before seen photos of the former newspaper owner and journalist is believed to have been murdered. So there still is information out there, and the contents of the photos that came to light 11 months ago were in 33 boxes, and they were unearthed in a lost Foy family archive. So with the emergence of some of this material that's never been seen, hopefully that information is now in the hands of the right people, we will begin to see something develop in this case. And no doubt, Jennifer, you'll keep us up to date with what's happening this weekend. You mentioned something happening in the main street of King's Cross at a cocktail bar.
Oh, yes, Dulcie's, which is a bohemian cocktail bar, and they're presenting Juanita's story. But you've got to remember, it's an ex-cop that's delivering the story, and by exposing Juanita Nelson's story, you actually unravel, I believe, allegedly links to corrupt coppers that were involved.
Okay, and for those interested in this story, you might want to keep your eye on commercial media in Sydney, Channel 7, and also the ABC for the continuation of the Juanita Nelson story. You're listening to Whistleblowers. We're going to continue now. Whilst we're talking about drugs and money, we've got a story this week in the Daily Telegraph, written by a prominent crime journalist, Shari Markson, titled "Drug Cops, Home Raids, Police Became Cooks to Ensnare Crooks." And Jennifer said when I met her this morning, she couldn't believe this story had come into the media, and we've done a little bit of investigation here on the internet. We can't find many videos or other sources of information for this story. So, Jennifer, when you heard about this story, and I can't see it anywhere else, it was broadcast briefly yesterday in the Sydney Daily Telegraph. It's a bizarre story, and if there's any truth in it, the voters of New South Wales, the ordinary citizens of New South Wales, would be shocked to hear about what's going on behind the scenes in this so-called war on drugs, where, you know, we've had people like the Police Commissioner Mick Fuller and others say that they're winning the war on drugs. Well, have a listen to this story.
Well, the police, you started to think when I was researching in King's Cross and exposing the drug network, and there's so many drug busts, how were these crooks that I could see getting the drugs? And one thought we had was they were coming out of the police station themselves. And many of the leads we had was the talk around, you know, the underbelly style talk, the secret society, the ombrata, you know, we're keeping this very tight-lipped, but it's coming out of the cops. And we couldn't expose this. We could expose a drug deal where they could get the drugs coming in from overseas. But for certain drug runners, they have still not been caught. And I'm still exposing to the cops. These guys have still not been caught.
So in essence, this story is about a plan. And is it part of the Strike Force Dominion? Or is it separate to that, where obviously undercovers were pretending or being involved in the production of the drugs themselves?
Okay. Strike Force Dominion is the one that the police, New South Wales, have been working on to expose the corruption allegedly within the police. So this has gone to the police professional standards, and there's no charges have been laid as yet. So the cops were actually selling the drugs and had approval from high up to do this. So if someone came looking for a kilo, they go, oh, we can supply it. And then they catch them out. But when this Strike Force Dominion actually did raids on a yacht at Balmain, it was kilos was loaded up on the wharf, and you can see. And those packages of methamphetamine looked exactly the same that had come from the Mexico drug bust.
All right, I'll just stop you there. So basically what we're looking at, and those that are interested in this story, if you put into a Google search drug squad cops raided, you'll see photographs from this week's Sydney Daily Telegraph of the drugs that Jennifer's talking about and how they're packaged and, you know, armed police and police in hazmat suits going through the drugs. And what you're saying and your instincts told you is that the way that they're all wrapped has something to do with international drug syndicates from your studies in Mexico and America, South America.
Yes, in the golden Southeast Asia, the golden triangle. So it was the way they were wrapped. So what I did was I looked for other drug raids where the pictures were the same as the packets of methamphetamine. And they came in April 2020 to a bus that had come from Mexico. And it was on a yacht. And this was a yacht. So like as though the yacht's getting sailed into Sydney Harbour and then they're selling it. So, okay, they'll catch some guys, but then they won't catch the big guys. Then the big guys have this protected supply chain that's happening, and where is all that money? Now, that's of interest to me and would be to all the viewers that are New South Wales voters as to what's happening with this and how come this has been approved by high-up police.
I'll have to see if I can get an invitation to a barbecue at Mick's place, because information like this we don't see broadcast. And I know for a fact that if you want a story on the front four or five pages of the Daily Telegraph, you need a good publicist. And this to me at the moment, because it's not widely covered by the other news outlets, sniffs of marketing. And somebody trying to push a particular message. And, you know, the sad message for people in Australia and New South Wales is we have lost the war on drugs, but our commercial media, and particularly one avenue of the commercial media, which conservative politics, you could say, use this media as their voice in Australia, want us to believe that we're winning the war on drugs. But we're not. As we can see in these photographs here, something is not right. And this probably leads us into talking about the price of drugs. Why are we not winning the war on drugs, Jennifer? It's got to do with your research of over, you know, 30 years here and the price of some of the drugs themselves. So this leads us on to, you know, I use the word dosage. What the average addict needs as a dosage, and why we see the war on drugs being lost and why we now see in this article police being involved in manufacturing the drugs and also taking drugs that have been confiscated from international raids and then being sent back out there again and sold to try and entrap some of the people that they've been trying to catch for years. So just tell us a little bit about the main illegal drugs and what you've discovered about pricing.
Well, the Woods Royal Commission, that actually allowed the drugs to be sold back out onto the street until deaths started to come. And that's exactly what's happened now. The deaths have come and people are saying that it's been cut with fentanyl. And that's an important coincidence as we keep pushing for the police to do our search warrant. So when I came to King's Cross in 2011, a point of heroin was $100 on Darlinghurst Road. And if you'd go and with a known about you as needing heroin, you would get a milkshake container with a spoon with your heroin on. So they need the spoon to heat it up. And they come away from the shop with a straw and just looking as though they were sucking a milkshake. There was nothing in it, $100. And it was quite common that this shop, what they were dealing was heroin and not much of the rest of the takeaway menu they had, bacon and eggs or running 24 hours a day. But they were doing a great trade on milkshakes.
Very good. I can't help but chuckle there. And the sad price for the person on the street who is, you know, for whatever reason, addicted to a substance. Often there's underlying issues of depression or anxiety. Sometimes it's recreational. We know a lot about the stimulant use here in Australia. And I'm sure there are really hardworking police, the majority of police and the different squads are working hard on behalf of the taxpayer and the citizen to get some results. But it must be increasingly frustrated from these hardworking police themselves to know that there's other things going on with, you know, the big fish, and they just seem to get away with more and more each year. They're a protected species, and when you read the Telegraph, you just see that the focus always seems to be on demonising the drugs themselves and demonising the addict on the street. And, you know, it all links in with the Juanita Nelson story. You know, people who have tried to bring this to light in the past in a very serious way, like she did, met with their demise. So, Jennifer, we've got a lot of crystal meth around these days. We've still got more heroin than ever. What's the pricing like on the street and where do you think the most of it's coming in from these days?
Well, I used to have a laugh to myself when the police car used to have the P-O-L missing on the side of it and it had ice. And I used to tell people that was the local ice dealer. And it was just a joke, but really, it starts to be a few people dealing drugs that you cannot bring down. Starts to make you wonder how this protected species exists. So the meth tray, some say our auntie on the street that I refer to, the Asian grandma, is moving between 30 to 50 billion a year. But the meth trade in Australia is worth about $90 billion a year. Now, that is a huge amount when you start to think this is like a government-sponsored drug network that was being exposed by the police themselves the other day. They made front page of the newspaper. So 2011, a shot of heroin was $100. If I moved off Darlinghurst Road, you could pick it up for $50. So the locals knew where to get it for $50, and it was the visitors to King's Cross, so the backpackers or the people that had come for the good weekend, would be paying the higher price. You then start to realise that in America, that was only a $20 hit back in 1974 when the Defoe family were murdered in the Amityville murders. But when Juanita Nelson went missing, a point was around a couple of years later, people would tell me it was about $50. And you start to think that's like a wealthy drug habit they've got. And what was supplying it, you know? Some say the home invasions, the, you know, stealing of jewellery and that sort of hawking of system of, you know, selling, you know, your stereos and that at the pub. But that's nearly been a bygone era now because people have got such good security systems on their home to protect them, you know.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And Southeast Asia is always on the police radar. Amazing. You want to add something more there, Jennifer, before we move on?
When I started to do the Spider-Man, the William Terrell case, I had a few researchers that linked into me that talked about the blue drum. Now, if we put William Terrell into a bucket with a lid, and people kept saying, no, 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 on the fishing trawlers, they're this blue drum. But also the blue drums are linked to the methamphetamine trade. And it's one of the ways that they've put them on the fishing trawlers to come out.
In particular with that is the pseudoephedrine is often transported via these blue chemical drums, you might call them. So you made the link between the chemical drum for the manufacture of other stimulant products like ecstasy, but the chemicals often behind them in their liquid form go into a blue drum. That's right.
Yeah. And so by putting a child into a bucket or a drum or with a lid, then his DNA would not be on a boat. So we come back to a boat. So the drugs coming into Sydney Harbour that this police raid caught one. But hang on a minute, they exposed the police were selling drugs in the Woods Royal Commission back in the 1994 to 96. And now in 2020, we've got the same system happening.
Very good, Jennifer. Thank you for that information. And we might, because we've gone over time, we might come back to the boats in Sydney Harbour. A fascinating story, the history behind the commercial boats that move in and out of our harbour quite innocently on a daily basis, and the distribution network and where things begin to head once they get on shore. So stay tuned to Whistleblowers. We'll be bringing you some information about the Pyrmont area of Sydney, the fish markets, in coming episodes. And I will ask Jennifer to return with an update on the little Spider-Man, because we know there's some things happening in Kendall after the Tyree inquest. So we'll bring you up to date with that. But before we finish, did you have anything else to say on this morning's topic before I talk about the tea lady's tips?
Anything more on today's topic?
The drug cops raid. Back in 2012-13, we had an idea of making magnesium product that's quite legal and you can buy it from a pharmacy, and making it look like pink heroin and seeing if that came back out onto the streets, linking to King's Cross Police Station. And it did. We believe it did, because people were saying they'd bought this pink heroin off respected drug dealers, and we'd say to them, which ones? They were the ones we thought that were protected. And that was where we had a lead that we sent back into the police. So as many leads that get to the police to do drug raids like this, as many leads and many years of research. But you still think from 1994 to 96, the Woods Royal Commission, that same research is still being really examined now in 2020 for them to see the same patterns existing.
Okay, there you hear it, folks. Whistleblowers, episode 9. We've covered Juanita Nielsen, the drug cops' home raids, and the price of drugs here in Sydney, New South Wales. We've covered some serious topics, and well, this could be serious if you do like to punt. And one of the ways Australians like to punt is on the horse races. And in weeks to come, Jennifer's going to bring us an episode all about the, you might say, behind the scenes of Australia's thoroughbred industry. But interesting, I caught her out one week when she mentioned the numbers 7 and 9. So if you're, it's a Saturday morning, if you're going to the races, you might want to listen to the end of this podcast, Jennifer. What's the significance of the 7 and 9 and the Tea Lady's tips?
Well, number 7 links to God or the Lord. And this gang, I believe, is they're making themselves to be the Lord on earth with their man-made heaven. So you start to think, number 7 is a number that plays quite close to their heart. And number 9 is always a number that links into, you know, the 9 evil families behind the drug network. And number 9 had come up in many of my research. So a couple of years ago, I started doing a bit of research on the Tea Lady's tips and the numbers on the horse racing as how could they be using this to clean funds. And I started to notice there was a pattern sometimes in certain numbers of the horse racing, and then the trifecta would add up to a 7 or a 9. And I started to think, hang on, this is a pattern. And the pattern linked to Melbourne and Brisbane. And I sent it into the police because it had taken me about 6 months, and I had actually been collating lots of newspapers with my research, and I even had to tell people I didn't have a gambling habit. I was just doing my research because they were shocked at how many pages I had been circling different horses on.
Well, there we go, folks. That's Whistleblowers with an entertaining end to today's podcast. And we might come back to horse racing because we've seen one of Australia's Melbourne Cup winning trainers arrested and banned from tracks for 4 years. They call it the mugs game, but there's always a fascination in Australia about the horse races, and Whistleblowers will return with a podcast on the crimes and the colourful characters that go to the races on a Saturday. Thanks, Jennifer, for being with us today. I'm sorry about my croaky voice, but I'm sure listeners will be interested in some of the topics that we've brought up today, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, you're welcome. And please like Jennifer on her Instagram page, her Facebook page, and her Twitter. And for all those listening to the Anchor podcast, you can hear this podcast on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Microsoft, or wherever you get your favourite podcast from. My name's Greg Kerr. Thanks for joining us today on Whistleblowers. Welcome to Whistleblowers, episode 9, 45 years since the disappearance of Juanita, the drug cops' home raids of this week, the price of drugs, and the Spider-Man coming to you today on Whistleblowers.
She believed in her principles. She believed in the right of ordinary Australians to have their say and be respected and not have to suffer for it.
Victoria Street, King's Cross. Worth saving, you'd think, from developers and their high-rise apartment blocks. Juanita Nielsen fought to protect it, and for that, she lost her life.
She certainly was aware of danger around her. She was aware of the history of what was happening.
Editor of a local newspaper, heiress to a family fortune, she was not your average radical. And David Farrell, business partner and boyfriend, knew her better than most.
This was the street where I lived for 7 years. This was Juanita's street. She was part of this community and she died for this community. But here we are. This was...
Still standing, number 202 Victoria Street, the tiny terrace they shared.
It's 20 years ago. What do you think about when you see this house again?
I think of a lot of good times. I think of the worthwhile things that happened in this street, and that I still believe that Sydney and King's Cross does have a heart. That heart's still there, and that heart remembers.
That story is actually 20 years old itself now. That story was made 20 years ago, and today's date, the 4th of July, 2020, is 45 years since Juanita went missing. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well.
I'm joined by Jennifer Stone, Australia's Murder She Wrote, crime author, investigative journalist, has been looking at the Juanita story all of her adult life. So before we listen to more of that broadcast from Channel 7, which is 20 years old, and Juanita went missing 45 years ago. Why have they got it wrong, do you think?
Well, they gave you a clue in that story. It was the heart of King's Cross. You know, I believe she's at the heart, the centre of the underworld today. Back in 2011, I sent an email in November 2011 to the police. I got a letter back, which I was shocked about. That was correspondence from the New South Wales Commissioner of Police, dated 3rd of December 2011, was when they received my research. It was regarding the unsolved murderer, Juanita Nielsen. It gave me a reference number, D/2011, for the year it was opened, and then 208952. That is a new case number for Juanita Nielsen. I actually did get information that was new to the case to reopen it. And that was where my compelling writing of the story regarding Juanita is to bring exposure to the position of the heart of King's Cross to raise her skull.
Was what has happened to all of Sydney, what has happened to the key, the centre of the city. There's just too much money around.
Only a few recordings of her survive.
A developer simply wants empty houses. They're more valuable. So, gradually, the people started leaving. There's very little of the old cross now.
You're going to endanger your own life, you're going to endanger the life of policemen.
By the early 70s, Victoria Street was changing fast and the fight against high-rise development had turned violent.
Okay, so Juanita was certainly a very good investigator like yourself, and she started uncovering information probably a little bit wider than property development. What unfolded in these days and weeks and months before her disappearance?
Well, she said it herself in that tape. It was too much money. Where was all this money coming from? Remember when Frank Thiemann's development was getting built. The estimate was $60 million back in 1975. That's a lot of money back in 1975 when a point of heroin was $20 in America and some say $50 on the strip in Darlinghurst Road back then. So that's a lot. If all this development was through the alleged drug dealing, was feeding it, well, that's what Juanita, I believe, died for, because that's what she was exposing. What was feeding this development? The money.
With Juanita Nielsen's disappearance, he still lives in Sydney. David Farrell thinks he knows why Arthur King survived the abduction and Juanita Nielsen did not.
She would not, from my knowledge, have given in easily. It would have been like bagging a fox. It would be very difficult to take Juanita easily. She would have fought.
What do you think is her legacy?
Old Victoria Street really still has some things that are worth going there for. It still has beautiful plane trees. It still has a mix of people from all over with different thoughts. It's not quite as diverse as it once was, but it still hums along.
So there we go. We've heard from a reporter 20 years ago, and today there is a small group of people meeting in the middle of King's Cross to commemorate Juanita and the Juanita Nielsen story. We've just heard from her ex-boyfriend there who lived with her in that unit, and people can go online and find out more about the Juanita Nielsen story. But you've been contacted by Channel 7 and somebody's organising something today. What do you think will ever happen with this story? I mean, so many cold cases have been solved over the years. You mentioned Juanita's skull and remains have never been found. So can you throw a little bit of light on, you know, in your mind, what might lie ahead with, you know, forensic science continuing to develop the way it is, even if we do uncover old DNA, etc. There still may be an end to this story in our lifetime.
Yes, there was. How I reopened the case was when I started to put the pieces together, the age of the guys were old, you know, about 20 years older than me, and they were threatening my life. And even this week I've had threats on Facebook to me, which I thought was interesting that as the, you know, the memorial time of Juanita, it's a very somber time, but, you know, the people will be gathering in Victoria Street with a red rose for some. A single red rose was what she loved. That was one of her favourite flowers. So it's interesting that some call it the Rose Cross that this gang had done to her, you know, that satanic rituals that I link into.
And police over the years, not just in this case but other cases as well, have gone beyond the realms of science when they cannot solve a case. And those detectives, we've heard many podcasts, you know, including Gary Jubelin recently, that have been saying they go outside, they're prepared to go outside the realms of what they've been taught at the police academies and, what science tells them. And, you know, some of these leads go somewhere, but very often they don't. In this case, you believe there could be something, a wider net with the, spirit world or underworld of that sort of dark nature?
Yes, well, the black magic was happening in King's Cross, 1975. There were meetings down Roslyn Street for that. It was Rosaline Norton would hold the meetings. The chemist shop would have a sign on Friday nights to not be open. You know, we had Juanita Nielsen just a couple of days before she went missing was door knocked at home, and it was to do with a meeting at the Carousel Club. They needed her somewhere where they could get to her. But Juanita was gathering information on, I believe, 16 people, and there's a lot of research out there saying it, 16 dossiers she was collecting. One of them was allegedly a police commissioner at the time. Many of the high-profile people she was collecting information on would be dead now, just like Abe Saffron. We know Victoria Street, some of that development was curtailed through her actions. But remember, she was looking for the money. And that part of the story has never been the focus of any of the newspaper reports or the television. They focus about Victoria Street development. They don't focus about the money and where the money came for these developments.
And as we heard in that interview from 20 years ago, there isn't actually much audio of Juanita being interviewed, so much of her information has probably gone, been disposed of by now, that she might have been studying or keeping online. 11 months ago, the diary came forward, and so never before seen photos of the former newspaper owner and journalist is believed to have been murdered. So there still is information out there, and the contents of the photos that came to light 11 months ago were in 33 boxes, and they were unearthed in a lost Foy family archive. So with the emergence of some of this material that's never been seen, hopefully that information is now in the hands of the right people, we will begin to see something develop in this case. And no doubt, Jennifer, you'll keep us up to date with what's happening this weekend. You mentioned something happening in the main street of King's Cross at a cocktail bar.
Oh, yes, Dulcie's, which is a bohemian cocktail bar. And they're presenting Juanita's story. But you've got to remember, it's an ex-cop that's delivering the story. And by exposing Juanita Nelson's story, you actually unravel, I believe, allegedly links to corrupt coppers that were involved.
Okay, and for those interested in this story, you might want to keep your eye on commercial media in Sydney, Channel 7, and also the ABC for the continuation of the Juanita Nelson story. You're listening to Whistleblowers. We're going to continue now. Whilst we're talking about drugs and money, we've got a story this week in the Daily Telegraph, written by a prominent crime journalist, Shari Markson, titled "Drug Cops Home Raids, Police Became Cooks to Ensnare Crooks." And Jennifer said when I met her this morning, she couldn't believe this story had come into the media, and we've done a little bit of investigation here on the internet. We can't find many videos or other sources of information for this story. So, Jennifer, when you heard about this story, and I can't see it anywhere else, it was broadcast briefly yesterday in the Sydney Daily Telegraph. It's a bizarre story, and if there's any truth in it, the voters of New South Wales, the ordinary citizens of New South Wales, would be shocked to hear about what's going on behind the scenes in this so-called war on drugs, where, you know, we've had people like the Police Commissioner Mick Fuller and others say that they're winning the war on drugs. Well, have a listen to this story.
Well, the police, you started to think when I was researching in King's Cross and exposing the drug network, and there's so many drug busts, how were these crooks that I could see getting the drugs? And one thought we had was they were coming out of the police station themselves. And many of the leads we had was the talk around, you know, the underbelly style talk, the secret society, the ombrata, you know, we're keeping this very tight-lipped. But it's coming out of the cops. And we couldn't expose this. We could expose a drug deal where they could get the drugs coming in from overseas. But for certain drug runners, they have still not been caught. And I'm still exposing to the cops. These guys have still not been caught.
So in essence, this story is about a plan, and is it part of the Strike Force Dominion, or is it separate to that, where obviously undercovers were pretending or being involved in the production of the drugs themselves?
Okay. Strike Force Dominion is the one that the police, New South Wales, have been working on to expose the corruption allegedly within the police. So this has gone to the police professional standards, and there's no charges have been laid as yet. So the cops were actually selling the drugs and had approval from high up to do this. So if someone came looking for a kilo, they go, oh, we can supply it. And then they catch them out. But when this Strike Force Dominion actually did raids on a yacht at Balmain, it was kilos was loaded up on the wharf, and you can see. And those packages of methamphetamine looked exactly the same that had come from the Mexico drug bust.
All right, I'll just stop you there. So basically what we're looking at, and those that are interested in this story, if you put into a Google search drug squad cops raided, you'll see photographs from this week's Sydney Daily Telegraph of the drugs that Jennifer's talking about and how they're packaged and, you know, armed police and police in hazmat suits going through the drugs. And what you're saying and your instincts told you is that the way that they're all wrapped has something to do with international drug syndicates from your studies in Mexico and America, South America.
Yes, and the golden Southeast Asia, the golden triangle. So it was the way they were wrapped. So what I did was I looked for other drug raids where the pictures were the same as the packets of methamphetamine, and they came in April 2020 to a bus that had come from Mexico, and it was on a yacht, and this was a yacht. So like as though the yacht's getting sailed into Sydney Harbour and then they're selling it. So, okay, they'll catch some guys, but then they won't catch the big guys. Then the big guys have this protected supply chain that's happening, and where is all that money? Now, that's of interest to me and would be to all the viewers that are New South Wales voters as to what's happening with this and how come this has been approved by high-up police.
I'll have to see if I can get an invitation to a barbecue at Mick's place, because information like this we don't see broadcast. And I know for a fact that if you want a story on the front four or five pages of the Daily Telegraph, you need a good publicist. And this to me, at the moment, because it's not widely covered by the other news outlets, sniffs of marketing. And somebody trying to push a particular message. And, you know, the sad message for people in Australia and New South Wales is we have lost the war on drugs. But our commercial media, and particularly one avenue of the commercial media, which conservative politics, you could say, use this media as their voice in Australia, want us to believe that we're winning the war on drugs. But we're not. As we can see in these photographs here, something is not right. And this probably leads us into talking about the price of drugs. Why are we not winning the war on drugs, Jennifer? It's got to do with your research of over, you know, 30 years here and the price of some of the drugs themselves. So this leads us on to, you know, I use the word dosage, what the average addict needs as a dosage, and why we see the war on drugs being lost, and why we now see in this article police being involved in manufacturing the drugs and also taking drugs that have been confiscated from international raids and then being sent back out there again and sold to try and entrap some of the people that they've been trying to catch for years. So just tell us a little bit about the main illegal drugs and what you've discovered about pricing.
Well, the Woods Royal Commission, that actually allowed the drugs to be sold back out onto the street until deaths started to come. And that's exactly what's happened now. The deaths have come and people are saying that it's been cut with fentanyl. And that's an important coincidence as we keep pushing for the police to do our search warrant. So when I came to King's Cross in 2011, a point of heroin was $100 on Darlinghurst Road. And if you'd go and with a known about you as needing heroin, you would get a milkshake container with a spoon with your heroin on. So they need the spoon to heat it up. And they come away from the shop with a straw and just looking as though they were sucking a milkshake. There was nothing in it, $100. And it was quite common that this shop, what they were dealing was heroin and not much of the rest of the takeaway menu they had, bacon and eggs or running 24 hours a day. But they were doing a great trade on milkshakes.
Very good. I can't help but chuckle there. And the sad price for the person on the street who is, you know, for whatever reason, addicted to a substance. Often there's underlying issues of depression or anxiety. Sometimes it's recreational. We know a lot about the stimulant use here in Australia. And I'm sure there are really hardworking police. The majority of police and the different squads are working hard on behalf of the taxpayer and the citizen to get some results. But it must be increasingly frustrated from these hardworking police themselves to know that there's other things going on with, you know, the big fish, and they just seem to get away with more and more each year. They're a protected species, and when you read the Telegraph, you just see that the focus always seems to be on demonising the drugs themselves and demonising the addict on the street. And, you know, it all links in with the Juanita Nelson story. You know, people who have tried to bring this to light in the past in a very serious way, like she did, met with their demise. So, Jennifer, we've got a lot of crystal meth around these days. We've still got more heroin than ever. What's the pricing like on the street, and where do you think most of it's coming in from these days?
Well, I used to have a laugh to myself when the police car used to have the P-O-L missing on the side of it, and it had ice. And I used to tell people that was the local ice dealer. And it was just a joke, but really, it starts to be a few people dealing drugs that you cannot bring down. Starts to make you wonder how this protected species exists. So the meth tray, some say our auntie on the street that I refer to, the Asian grandma, is moving between 30 to 50 billion a year. But the meth trade in Australia is worth about $90 billion a year. Now, that is a huge amount when you start to think this is like a government-sponsored drug network that was being exposed by the police themselves the other day. They made front page of the newspaper. So 2011, a shot of heroin was $100. If I moved off Darlinghurst Road, you could pick it up for $50. So the locals knew where to get it for $50, and it was the visitors to King's Cross, so the backpackers or the people that had come for the good weekend, would be paying the higher price. You then start to realise that in America, that was only a $20 hit. Back in 1974, when the Defoe family were murdered in the Amityville murders. But when Juanita Nelson went missing, a point was around a couple of years later, was people would tell me it was about $50. And you start to think that's like a wealthy drug habit they've got. And what was supplying it, you know? Some say the home invasions, the, you know, stealing of jewellery and that sort of hawking of system of, you know, selling, you know, your stereos and that at the pub. But that's nearly been a bygone era now because people have got such good security systems on their home to protect them, you know.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And Southeast Asia is always on the police radar. Amazing. You want to add something more there, Jennifer, before we move on?
When I started to do the Spider-Man, the William Terrell case, I had a few researchers that linked into me that talked about the blue drum. Now, if we put William Terrell into a bucket with a lid, and people kept saying, no, 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 on the fishing trawlers, they're this blue drum. But also the blue drums are linked to the methamphetamine trade, and it's one of the ways that they've put them on the fishing trawlers to come out.
In particular with that is the pseudoephedrine is often transported via these blue chemical drums, you might call them. So you made the link between the chemical drum for the manufacture of other stimulant products like ecstasy, but the chemicals often behind them in their liquid form go into a blue drum. That's right.
Yeah. And so by putting a child into a bucket or a drum or with a lid, then his DNA would not be on a boat. So we come back to a boat. So the drugs coming into Sydney Harbour, that this police raid caught one, but hang on a minute, they exposed the police were selling drugs in the Woods Royal Commission back in the 1994 to 1996, and now in 2020 we've got the same system happening.
Very good, Jennifer. Thank you for that information. And we might, because we've gone over time, we might come back to the boats in Sydney Harbour. A fascinating story, the history behind the commercial boats that move in and out of our harbour quite innocently on a daily basis, and the distribution network and where things begin to head once they get on shore. So stay tuned to Whistleblowers. We'll be bringing you some information about the Pyrmont area of Sydney, the fish markets, in coming episodes. And I will ask Jennifer to return with an update on the little Spider-Man, because we know there's some things happening in Kendall after the Taree inquest. So we'll bring you up to date with that. But before we finish, did you have anything else to say on this morning's topic before I talk about the tea lady's tips?
Anything more on today's topic?
The drug cops raid. Back in 2012-13, we had an idea of making magnesium product that's quite legal and you can buy it from a pharmacy, and making it look like pink heroin and seeing if that came back out onto the streets, linking to King's Cross Police Station. And it did. We believe it did, because people were saying they'd bought this pink heroin off respected drug dealers, and we'd say to them, which ones? They were the ones we thought that were protected. And that was where we had a lead that we sent back into the police. So there's many leads that get to the police to do drug raids like this. There's many leads and many years of research. But you still think from 1994 to 1996, the Woods Royal Commission, that same research is still being really examined now in 2020 for them to see the same patterns existing.
Okay, there you hear it, folks. Whistleblowers, episode 9. We've covered Juanita Nielsen, the drug cops' home raids, and the price of drugs here in Sydney, New South Wales. We've covered some serious topics, and well, this could be serious if you do like to punt. And one of the ways Australians like to punt is on the horse races. And in weeks to come, Jennifer's going to bring us an episode all about the, you might say, behind the scenes of Australia's thoroughbred industry. But interesting, I caught her out one week when she mentioned the numbers 7 and 9. So if you're, it's a Saturday morning, if you're going to the races, you might want to listen to the end of this podcast, Jennifer. What's the significance of the 7 and 9 and the Tea Lady's tips?
Well, number 7 links to God or the Lord. And this gang, I believe, is they're making themselves to be the Lord on earth with their man-made heaven. So you start to think, number 7 is a number that plays quite close to their heart. And number 9 is always a number that links into, you know, the 9 evil families behind the drug network. And number 9 had come up in many of my research. So a couple of years ago, I started doing a bit of research on the Tea Lady's tips and the numbers on the horse racing as how could they be using this to clean funds. And I started to notice there was a pattern sometimes in certain numbers of the horse racing, and then the trifecta would add up to a 7 or a 9. And I started to think, hang on, this is a pattern. And the pattern linked to Melbourne and Brisbane. And I sent it into the police because it had taken me about 6 months, and I had actually been collating lots of newspapers with my research, and I even had to tell people I didn't have a gambling habit. I was just doing my research because they were shocked at how many pages I had been circling different horses on.
Well, there we go, folks. That's Whistleblowers with an entertaining end to today's podcast. And we might come back to horse racing because we've seen one of Australia's Melbourne Cup winning trainers arrested and banned from tracks for 4 years. They call it the mugs game, but there's always a fascination in Australia about the horse races, and Whistleblowers will return with a podcast on the crimes and the colourful characters that go to the races on a Saturday. Thanks, Jennifer, for being with us today. I'm sorry about my croaky voice, but I'm sure listeners will be interested in some of the topics that we've brought up today, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Okay, you're welcome. And please like Jennifer on her Instagram page, her Facebook page, and her Twitter. And for all those listening to the Anchor podcast, you can hear this podcast on Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Microsoft, or wherever you get your favourite podcast from. My name's Greg Kerr. Thanks for joining us today on Whistleblowers. Welcome to Whistleblowers. My name is Greg Kerr, episode 10, The Woods Royal Commission.
The King's Cross segment of the Wood Royal Commission commenced on the 26th of April, 1995. Drug dealers, club owners, and standover men were interrogated about police corruption. Each of the King's Cross detectives were recalled, and accusations of extreme corruption were put to them. Once again, the wall of silence prevailed, but the noose was beginning to tighten.
To those police who are corrupt, and know they are corrupt, if you are called as a witness and you lie, or you try to cover up for others, and the consequences for you are likely to be particularly serious. Those who lie to commissions of inquiry such as this must expect significant periods in jail.
June the 5th was an enormous day. It was a pivotal point for the commission.
It was tense, as I remember it. Just so we can establish a benchmark, Mr. Fowler, it has been your position, hasn't it, that you've never been in receipt of corrupt monies? That's correct. Corruption and you are strangers, in answer. That's correct. I'm now going to show you, Mr. Fowler, a video, which is an excerpt of some of the Commission's holdings.
Welcome to Whistleblowers, the Royal Commission into the New South Wales Police Force, also known as the Wood Royal Commission, was a royal commission held in the state of New South Wales, Australia, between 1995 and 1997. The Royal Commissioner, whose voice we just heard, was Justice James Roland Wood. The terms of reference were to determine the extent and existence of corruption within the New South Wales Police. Specifically, it sought to determine whether corruption and misconduct were systemic and entrenched within the service and to advise on the process to address this problem. In 1995, the Commission received letters patent widening the terms of reference to include investigating not only the activities of money laundering and drugs and extortion, but it extended them to the pedophile networks in New South Wales. This is suitability of care arrangements for at-risk minors and the effectiveness of police guidelines for the investigation of sex offenders against minors. And at that point, I'll say good morning to Jennifer Stone. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Oh, good morning.
I'm sure you've been busy lately and you've come into the studio this morning full of life and enthusiasm. You're a crime writer, investigative journalist, and people have been enjoying the previous podcasts on the Anchor app and through wherever you get your podcast from. We're going to focus on this Woods Royal Commission, and you've done a lot of research over the years. Why did you bring this in this morning to talk about it?
Well, it was interesting. You've got to go through the Woods Royal Commission to see where they went wrong. And by seeing where they went wrong starts to expose the links that I've been following for the years. So what we've just heard was about the Detective Fowler and him getting a payout off another detective called Trevor Haken. It's interesting, Trevor Haken was never crucified, though he was used as a pawn within the Woods Royal Commission. He was linked into, clearing the money and paying the corrupt coppers. But, you know, it's hard to expose that when cash. And that's one of the reasons why I think the cashless society is what the governments have been working towards. So during the Woods Royal Commission, there were premises in King's Cross. It's not just the faces and the names. Those names and faces linked to certain properties.
Such as some of those names might be commonly remembered names by many of our listeners out there today. Are you able to remember some of those names for us?
Well, we've had Abe Saffron. He didn't really get picked up at all during this, but he was named. He was more linked into the missing person of Juanita Nelson. We had Bill Bayer. He got caught. He was known as the King of Cocaine back then and made front page of the newspaper where he walked into the Woods Royal Commission and never walked out. Down those steps he went. There were many that went there, joining him, but there's some that have never been exposed either. So we have the police in King's Cross at the time were actually about half of the King's Cross police force were removed, but half stayed, and that's the problem. It wasn't just the half that stayed. It was like, well, what did the other half do that left the police force? So that's what I've been following too. Where did they go? What did they do? Where, you know, and some of it you cannot find. You know, when you get to the Rogerson and McNamara trial, you heard links of McNamara ringing up people that linked into those times. You had faces that turned up for the court that had never been heard of in like 15 years. And you think, but they were still pulling the strings on those ex-coppers, Rogerson and McNamara.
One has the image of birds being let out of a cage and flying away.
It's truly remarkable, almost as remarkable as the film itself.
Hang in there and shit yourself, huh?
When asked, well, how do you explain these videos, effectively he said, well, you must have got an actor to play my role. I don't think you'd see too many knees like that around the acting profession.
After the video was played to the court, Mr. Fowler was asked again if he was not involved in corruption. He answered, that's right. Counsel assisting then asked, why can't you be man enough to admit your involvement?
That footage didn't go just around Australia, it went around the world, and of course then followed by Trevor Haken.
Mr. Haken, very early in the life of this Royal Commission, were you approached by Commander Hedgkiss and myself? And he said, I was. And I asked him, and did you, from that point in time, agree to assist the Royal Commission in its investigations into corruption in the New South Wales Police Service? And he said, yes.
So, Jennifer, I was a young boy when a lot of this was happening, and you know, I remember my father and people in general in society were very shocked at just how deep these allegations went. And the Wood Royal Commission was successful in some ways, but what your investigation has uncovered is it really didn't achieve what it set out to do in many ways. There was businesses that didn't get properly investigated, and maybe some of the links continue today.
Yes. So many of the businesses that were investigated, the main ones were the Budget Hotel, and that was proved at the time that it was sending money over to South Africa. And it was interesting, Abe Saffron's wife was from South Africa. We had the Pink Panther, which is now where Stripperama is, and it's still working in 2020, maybe a lot less hours. The Penthouse Snooker Room, we had Porky's, which is now closed, Playbird International, we had the Cosmopolitan Coffee Lounge, that's now gone, well, it's moved to Double Bay for the Double Cross. We have the Lasers Amusement Parlour, Illusion Nightclub, 40 Darlinghurst Road, 48 Darlinghurst Road, the Pink Flamingo Massage Parlour and the Bargain Backpackers Hotel. Where else were the amusement parlours linking? Cronulla. And there were a couple of young girls went missing there. So 2018, the Love Machine, Butterbing and the Pink Flamingo all were shut. Then there's a note. So Porky's had a sign up, Porky's Gentleman's Bar, B-A-R. And what I noticed in King's Cross, that the B-A-R linked to certain places. The Piccolo Bar is a cafe, nothing to do with serving alcohol, but it has the bar. And bar links to what I have been thinking as allegedly bandidos, angels and rebels are welcome. So this is the key to nomads. You know, it was something that stood out to me, and I actually started to send it to the police. Then we noticed on a couple of the shops, as the police raided them with the BAR plastered on the front windows and the drugs were getting caught, that another place would open and it would have the same thing. Not now, that system's been exposed, but it was quite interesting to see that I was right about it and no one had really picked it up. So you've got to go through. In the Woods Royal Commission at 4.140, the arrangements in respect to the premises were when there was going to be a drug deal, drug raid, there was going to be prior warnings of raids, diversion of the drug unit activity to unprotected operations, and show raids without any thorough search being made. Now, that's a key to what I have been exposing, that there was not a thorough search made during the time. So these premises linked into KX1, KX6, KX8. There'll be many more that I haven't really linked. So the brothel focused upon at the time the Pink Flamingo, owned by Pandelis Karapas, a.k.a. Fat George. It's interesting at the time that Fat George and Fat Steve, who came from 44 Darlinghurst Road, would have meetings out the front of King's Cross Police Station out on the footpath. And I thought that was interesting because it was held in the open and the police were just letting them have their big, you know, verbal discussions. So within the research, it was exposed by the Woods Royal Commission, Capacis was part of a cartel or brotherhood that controlled a sizable slice of Sydney drug trade, in cahoots with bank cops, judicial figures and other people in key positions of power. So KX8 was a working girl that gave evidence, and Capacis was eventually jailed as the results from the Royal Commission. So what did they miss? The subfloor in this brothel in King's Cross. And that's a key that not many have come up with. So what I started exposing this back in 2011. It was right at the end of 2011. 2012, I was then writing letters to just Judge Wood to show him, though he wasn't on the bench at the time, to show him what could have happened, right? To see if I could get some help. You know what he did? He came back on the bench. You know, this is like keeping your finger on the pulse. So we've got to figure out, why didn't he order those premises to be searched properly? Now, Bill Bayer was caught terrorising the owners of it back in 85, 86 with Lenny McPherson. And Lenny McPherson was in prison at the time and he was asked, did he want to talk to the Woods Royal Commission? But he was already in prison. Why get yourself into a bigger, deeper crap, you know? You start to wonder. But it's interesting that Trevor Haken, he just went into sublimial, hidden, and he stayed in Australia. His family ran overseas, his wife and daughter, but he kind of stayed. Why? You think you would go. You wouldn't be staying around, you know. So really, did he set some of the people up? Yes. But then, you know, like as you go through some of the research, he's used many aliases. Why? Why not just run overseas? That was something that would go through my mind time and time again.
Yes, excellent. And interestingly, from that time, the police commissioner at the time, Tony Lauer, stated that the corruption in New South Wales police force was not systemic or entrenched. The sensational revelations that Jennifer's touched on, and as we've just heard, out of the Royal Commission hearings, and Tony Lauer's emphatic assertion that corruption was not an issue made his position untenable as the commission drew out some video evidence of corruption from the New South Wales Police Force. So Tony Lauer resigned shortly after the publication of the Commissioner's initial report. And as Jennifer's saying, it could have gone further, but it was blocked at that top level. So even then, we had a hard-hitting British policeman recruited from the United Kingdom as the new commissioner, Peter Ryan. People will remember Peter Ryan took over at this time, and drug testing. He implemented a lot of the recommendations from the commission, including drug testing of serving officers, integrity testing, and more thorough supervision. The New South Wales government also undertook a series of legislative changes which resulted in the majority of recommendations from the Wood Royal Commission being consolidated. They included the questioning and investigation procedures that followed arrest. So Tony Lauer resigned. He's got to live with the fact that he protected a lot of police. Yeah. There was corruption rampant. Do you remember anything from this time?
I agree. It's very hard to expose the corruption. I have tried. So I do agree. Very hard. The interesting part is that they could go from a size 12, well, you know, a 32, 34 size man and joining the police force and then double their size in like 10 weeks and muscles on muscles without going to the gym a lot. Hang on a minute. That's the use of steroids and that's a form of payment. So the testing of the police that are in the force today needs to be done on a regular basis. They need to come in and do their breath testing and those sorts of testings, to a urine test to pick up drug use. They need to do it like once a month or once every 2 weeks or something as a regular thing. And that will expose some of this problem. It will stop it in its tracks. You know, the other way is to legalise the drugs. And that will stop the murders, the missing persons, and the pedophilia.
And that's legalising, you know, certain drugs and whatnot. We might do another episode on that. But, Jennifer, that's fantastic information on the Wood Royal Commission. But is there anything you would like to add from your research about it?
The drug cartels and how the Brotherhood works. The Brotherhood linked into the theory of the black magic that I write about and the theory of Rosaline Norton. So Rosaline Norton was down in Roslyn Gardens when she died. She was actually at St Vincent's Hospital, but she was in Roslyn, down Roslyn Gardens. She was a figure in King's Cross and teaching black magic. And interesting, when she died, there were 200 students that were learning. They used to have black mass on a Friday night. And that was linked as a brotherhood or former brotherhood, but it was never fully exposed, you know, which is interesting. And I've talked to, over the time before he died, Neville Drury, who did a lot of studies through the University of New South Wales and Sydney on Rosaline Norton. And he had read some of my submissions and I wanted his thoughts, but he was actually quite sick with cancer at the time, which I was not aware of. And he was saying to me that my research and what he knew about Rosaline Norton were two things that he wished he could survive to see the end of be exposed.
Very interesting. So there we have it, folks. The Wood Royal Commission, criticised by many, but changing the face of the New South Wales police force forever. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Whistleblowers. Don't go far away. We're going to back this one up with another episode that follows on from the Woods Royal Commission. It's the death of Carolyn Byrne.